You have probably heard the rumor. It is one of those things that just floats around internet forums.
Oh, yeah, constantly. It's everywhere.
Right. And it comes up in late night conversations all the time. It is totally woven into pop culture. The idea that at the exact moment of death, your human brain just floods itself with a massive dose of a psychedelic molecule.
Right, specifically DMT.
Exactly. That the white light, the tunnel, that overwhelming peace you always hear about, well, that it is all just one final spectacular chemical trip.
It is an incredibly sticky cultural narrative.
Yeah.
And, it is easy to see why we are drawn to it.
It's comforting,
It
Rio.
really is.
You're
It
back.
provides a neat biological mechanism for something that is just profoundly mysterious.
Yeah.
We like the comfort of thinking there is a tangible chemical key turning in a lock right at the end. It essentially explains away the great unknown.
It does feel comforting to think we have it all figured out. So today, we're doing a deep dive into investigation from the OOTW Journal that tackles this head on.
Yeah, we are looking at the actual science of DMT and near-death experiences.
The mission here is to sift through all this hauntingly beautiful science, separate it from the popular myths, and figure out what we actually know about consciousness reaching that final threshold.
It is a fascinating area of study.
It really is. And what really struck me in these sources is just how rare it is to find hard clinical numbers attached to something as ethereal and, I mean, frankly, as subjective as the afterlife.
Oh, absolutely. Taking something that subjective and putting it under a microscope is a massive challenge.
I can imagine.
The biological clues we are going to explore today are spectacular, but they're also going to make a lot of people uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable how?
Well, they challenge staunch believers who might resist the idea that a profound spiritual event has a chemical or electrical mimic.
Oh, right. I see.
But at the same time, they challenge hardened skeptics who are going to have to face just how incredibly vivid, structured, and coherent a dying brain can actually be.
That makes a lot of sense. So, to even begin looking inside the brain for those clues, we have to start with a seemingly impossible problem. Like, how do scientists even measure a near-death experience?
That's a million-dollar question.
Right. How do you move from a subjective anecdote, someone waking up in a hospital bed and saying, I saw a bright light, to rigorous, quantifiable data?
That measurement problem is the exact hurdle that kept this entire field out of mainstream science for, well, for the better part of a century.
Because you can't exactly put a ghost in a test tube.
Exactly. You really can't. But what you can do is standardize the human reporting of the experience.
Okay.
So in 2018, a team of neuroscientists led by Chris Timmerman at Imperial College London designed this deceptively simple yet brilliant study.
What did they do?
They brought 13 healthy volunteers into a clinical setting and administered intravenous DMT.
Just to give you some context, if you aren't familiar with the pharmacology here, DMT is an overwhelmingly powerful, very fast-acting psychedelic compound.
Extremely fast.
Yeah. When administered intravenously, the peak experience hits in just 2 to 3 minutes. And the whole thing is essentially over in 15. It is just an intense rocket ship ride of a substance.
And because it is so short and intense, it makes for a perfect laboratory variable.
That makes sense.
After the volunteers came down from that ride, the researchers had them fill out a highly specific measurement tool. It is known as the Grayson Near-Death Experience Scale.
Okay, let's unpack this. The Grayson scale.
Right. Clinicians have actually relied on this scale since 1983. It is a 16-item clinical standard that asks very pointed questions.
Questions about what exactly?
Things like cognitive, affective, paranormal, and transcendental features of an experience.
Wow.
And if a patient scores a 7 or higher out of 32 possible points, medically speaking, they have had a near-death experience.
I love the methodology here. The Grayson scale essentially functions like a standardized Yelp review for the afterlife.
A Yelp review, yeah, that's exactly it.
Imagine you are handed this questionnaire, and it is asking you to rate things like, did you feel a sudden sense of universal peace?
Right.
Or did you feel separated from your physical body? Did you encounter unearthly realms or sentient presences?
Exactly. And the Imperial College researchers took these Yelp reviews from healthy people who just tripped on DMT and compared them directly to the Yelp reviews of people who had actually survived flatlining.
That is such a clever comparison. Where did they get the flatlining data?
Well, the control group is what makes this study so fascinating.
Yeah.
That comparison data was drawn from a coma science registry.
Okay.
So it was populated by people who had genuine life-threatening brushes with clinical death.
Wow. And what happened when they compared them?
When they laid the two sets of data side by side, the results were uncanny. All 13 of the DMT volunteers scored well above the clinical threshold.
Wait, all 13?
Every single one of them. They all crossed the line into a near-death experience on paper.
But the truly wild part of the data is the item-by-item breakdown. On 15 of the 16 features on that standardized questionnaire, the DMT experiences were statistically indistinguishable from the experiences of people who had actually survived cardiac arrest.
Yes, there was almost zero measurable difference.
That is staggering. The patients who nearly died, sometimes up to 15 years prior, were reporting the exact same feelings of cosmic unity, the same out-of-body sensations, and the exact same unearthly presences.
At the exact same intensity, too.
Right. As someone who just took a synthetic psychedelic in a lab on a random Tuesday, they brought back the exact same postcards from what appears to be the same destination.
And to understand just how real that destination is for those who genuinely approach death, we really should look at a landmark 2001 study.
One in The Lancet.
Yes, published in The Lancet by cardiologist Pim van Lommel. His team rigorously tracked 344 patients who were resuscitated from cardiac arrest.
And what did they find?
A full 18% of them reported a near-death experience.
18% is huge.
It is. And what really stood out was the lack of clear predictive factors. It wasn't influenced by the specific medications they were on, how long their brain was deprived of oxygen, or their prior psychological background.
It's just a stubborn phenomenon.
Exactly. These experiences are a stubbornly real, relatively common phenomena.
Yeah.
Almost one in five people who come back experience this.
So when this molecule, DMT, seemingly replicates that phenomenon perfectly, it just rushes in to fill the vacuum of our understanding.
Absolutely.
But I do want to bring up the one single exception in the Timmerman study because I find it incredibly poignant.
Oh, the border question.
Yes. Out of those 16 questions, the only feature where the actual cardiac arrest survivors scored higher than the DMT volunteers was the feeling of reaching a border or a point of no return.
Right.
The people on DMT simply didn't feel that specific sensation.
Which, if you think about it, tracks perfectly with the psychology of the situation. Well, the DMT volunteers were lying comfortably in a clinical lab. They were fully aware that medical professionals were monitoring their vitals.
Oh, right. They knew they were perfectly safe.
Exactly. The safety net was obvious to them. They didn't feel the edge of life and death because they simply weren't at the edge.
But they crossed almost every other threshold on that list.
They really did.
Which naturally leads to the most obvious assumption you could possibly make. If a DMT trip feels statistically identical to dying, the brain must be dumping its own endogenous DMT when the heart stops, right?
That is the logical leap everyone makes.
Is that what is causing that 18% of people in Van Lommel's study to see the light? This is where that popular internet rumor we started with bumps up against some very, very complicated biology.
It does. The cultural narrative almost entirely traces back to a psychiatrist named Rick Strassman.
Right, back in 2001.
Yes, he published a widely read book called DMT, the Spirit Molecule.
I remember that one being huge.
It was massive. In it, he hypothesized that the pineal gland, which is this tiny structure in the center of the brain that the philosopher Descartes famously called the seat of the soul, he thought it secretes massive amounts of DMT.
Like at specific times.
Right, at birth, during deep REM sleep, and at the ultimate moment of death.
It is an undeniably poetic idea. It assigns this monumental, mystical purpose to a tiny, pea-sized gland. But the source material makes a really critical distinction here.
It does.
As a piece of hard science, it was pure speculation. At the time of that book's publication, and honestly, even today, there has never been a definitive demonstration that the human pineal gland releases DMT in quantities large enough to cause a psychoactive trip.
Exactly. It is a compelling hypothesis, mm-hmm. but it got adopted by pop culture as a settled biological fact.
But science naturally kept digging. Modern biochemistry started catching up to these ideas.
Yes, it did. By 2019, a research team, including Jimmo Borgigin at the University of Michigan, began looking deeply into the mammalian brain.
To see where DMT actually lives.
Precisely. And what they uncovered completely dismantled the obsession with the pineal gland.
Really? What did they find?
They found that the specific enzyme required to synthesize DMT isn't isolated there at all. It is broadly distributed across multiple regions of the brain.
Meaning the factory equipment needed to manufacture this psychedelic is just woven throughout our standard neural hardware.
Woven everywhere. And it is actively producing.
Wow.
In the cerebral cortex of rats, the researchers found that extracellular DMT, meaning the DMT actively floating between neurons, naturally reaches concentrations comparable to essential neurotransmitters.
Like serotonin and dopamine.
Exactly. It is just present, part of the baseline chemistry. But the critical experiment came when these researchers induced experimental cardiac arrest in the rats.
Oh, this is the wild part.
As the rats were dying, the DMT levels actively surged, particularly in their visual cortex.
Okay.
And the real nail in the coffin for the old theory, this surge, happened even in rats that had their pineal glands surgically removed prior to the experiment.
So the pineal gland was a red herring the whole time.
Totally a red herring.
The broader brain is just manufacturing it on demand. But wait, hold on. Here's where it gets really interesting, but I have to stop the train here for a second.
Go for it.
Because we are talking about lab rats.
Yes, we are.
The researchers removed a rat's pineal gland, induced cardiac arrest in a rat, and measured a rat's visual cortex. Just because a rodent's brain chemistry spikes with DMT during death, can we legitimately make the leap that human brains flood with enough of this specific molecule to trigger a full-blown, life-altering near-death experience?
This raises an important question.
It feels like a massive biological jump. Are we jumping the gun?
It is a massive jump, and you are entirely right to put the brakes on here. The bridge connecting a dying rat brain synthesizes some DMT to complex human near-death experiences are fueled entirely by a DMT flood. Well, that bridge simply hasn't been built by the data yet.
Right.
The rat study is an incredible biological breadcrumb. It tells us the mammalian brain is capable of this synthesis under extreme stress.
But we can't state it as a fact for humans.
No, we cannot state as a biological fact that humans experience a psychoactive DMT flood at the moment of death, based solely on rodent biochemistry.
So if we can't definitively prove a human brain is running its own psychedelic laboratory at death, how do we explain the hyperlucid clarity of those survivors?
That is the next logical step.
If it is not a massive exotic chemical dump, what on earth is happening in those final moments? It turns out we might be looking at the wrong system entirely. We might just need to look at the electricity.
This takes us back to the Borjigin lab. The same team that measured the DMT in those rats.
Okay.
6 years earlier, in 2013, they made a fundamentally astonishing discovery about how the brain shuts down. The medical assumption had always been that when a body goes into cardiac arrest, the brain simply powers down in a linear, quiet fashion.
Oxygen levels drop, metabolic activity slows, and it just fades to black.
Exactly.
I picture it like a smartphone running out of battery. The screen just slowly dims until it goes completely dark.
That was the expectation. But to test this, they hooked these rats up to an EEG monitor.
Which is a device that records the electrical chatter and brainwave patterns, right?
Right, across different regions of the brain. And within about 30 seconds of the heart stopping, as the oxygen plummeted, but before the monitor went completely flat, they didn't see a quiet fade.
What did they see?
They saw a transient, explosive surge of highly synchronized gamma wave activity.
Okay, let's break that down for a second. Gamma waves. Think about the last time you had a massive aha moment, like a sudden flash of intense clarity or focus. Your brain was heavily utilizing gamma waves. What exactly is that frequency doing in our heads?
Gamma waves are essentially the brain's highest operating frequency. They are associated with a process called conscious binding.
Conscious binding?
Yes, it is the electrical mechanism your brain uses to stitch together disparate sensory inputs, vision, sound, memory, emotion, into one unified, vivid perception of reality.
Oh, wow. So when you are deeply meditating or having a profound realization, gamma networks are firing in sync.
Exactly. What shocked the researchers was that in the dying rat brain, this gamma activity actually exceeded the electrical coherence and connectivity of a normal, healthy waking state.
That is just wild to think about. I mean, I picture it like an old school incandescent light bulb. You know, when one of those bulbs is nearing the end of its life, it doesn't always just gently fade out.
Right. Sometimes it flares.
Exactly. Sometimes, for a split second, right before the filament finally snaps, it burns at its absolute blinding brightest. The dying brain is doing exactly that. It is not just fading, it is flaring.
What's fascinating here is that this flare offers a completely drug-free, purely electrical blueprint for a hyperlucid final experience.
Because it's functioning at a higher level than when awake.
Yes. The brain is briefly functioning in a more hyperconnected state than when you're wide awake. And importantly, we now have data showing this isn't just a quirk of rodents.
Oh, we have human data on this now.
We do. In 2023, a researcher named Zhu and a team of colleagues monitored 4 human patients. These were patients who were comatose and having life support withdrawn.
Did they capture that same light bulb flare in human patients?
They captured it beautifully in 2 of the 4 patients.
Incredible.
As the oxygen levels dropped, they witnessed a very similar, highly organized gamma surge. And crucially, it was localized in the posterior hot zone of the cortex.
Which is what, exactly?
It is a network of brain regions deeply associated with conscious perception and visual hallucination.
Wow.
Now, because these patients ultimately passed away, we obviously can't ask them what they saw or felt during that electrical surge. But the data strongly suggests the human brain also flares brilliantly before it finally fades.
So we find ourselves looking at 2 very different blueprints for these vivid experiences. We have the chemical theory, where the brain might manufacture its own DMT, and we have the electrical theory, where the brain orchestrates a highly synchronized gamma flare.
Right. 2 distinct possibilities.
Are we missing a piece of the puzzle here? Because to really understand the architecture of consciousness at that threshold, we have to introduce a massive variable from the data involving a completely different substance altogether.
We do. In 2019, a researcher named Charlotte Marshall and her team approached this from a completely different angle. They conducted a massive text analysis study.
How massive?
They gathered roughly 15,000 written reports from people detailing their experiences on 165 different psychoactive drugs.
That is a lot of trip reports.
It is. They then took all of that descriptive language and ran a semantic comparison against 625 real, authenticated narratives from near-death survivors.
So they essentially fed all these trip reports into a database to see which specific drug produced stories that sounded the most like a genuine near-death experience.
Exactly.
And the compound that won the semantic matching game, the one that sounded the most like dying, was not DMT.
No, it wasn't.
It was ketamine. Hold on, ketamine. I mean, I associate that with surgical anesthetics.
Right, or underground club drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Not a profound spiritual awakening. How does a tranquilizer mimic the afterlife better than the spirit molecule?
It creates an incredible pharmacological paradox.
Yeah.
To understand why it's so strange, you have to look at how these 2 drugs operate in the brain.
Okay, lay it out for me.
Ketamine works by blocking something called the NMDA glutamate receptor. It basically shuts down excitatory pathways in the brain.
Got it.
When you block those signals, the brain loses its connection to the physical body and the external environment, leading to a profound dissociative state.
Okay, and what about DMT?
DMT, conversely, works by stimulating the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor. It actively excites and floods a completely different neural network with excess connectivity.
Wait, so they are fundamentally opposite mechanisms?
Exactly.
A glutamate blocker like ketamine basically acts like a master volume knob, turning down all the physical sensory input until your mind feels entirely detached from your physical form.
Yes.
While a serotonin stimulator like DMT acts as an amplifier, blasting the brain with hyperconnected, vivid hallucinations.
Opposite approaches, yep. Yet they lead to the exact same destination.
That is wild.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, if a near-death experience can be faithfully replicated by a serotonin amplifier or by a glutamate volume knob or even by the sheer electrical crescendo of a dying brain running out of oxygen,
it forces a paradigm shift.
It strongly implies there is no single death chemical. There is no magic biological key that unlocks the afterlife.
So what does this all mean? To me, it feels like the architecture of a video game.
How do you mean?
Well, it is as if the near-death experience, the brilliant light, the overwhelming peace, the complete dissolution of the ego is a secret developer room hidden deep within the foundational code of the human brain.
Oh, I like that analogy.
And there are several distinct ways to glitch your way into that room. You can input the DMT cheat code, you can input the ketamine cheat code, or you can naturally click through the wall when the console loses power and the oxygen drops during cardiac arrest.
Right.
But the room itself, that profound destination, isn't created by the cheat codes. The room is a fundamental piece of our built-in neural architecture.
That is the deepest lesson hidden in all of this data. When the ordinary, everyday network that models our sense of self is pushed past its breaking point by an exogenous chemical, by the sudden loss of oxygen, or by a surge of electricity, it defaults to the exact same family of profound experiences.
It all leads back there.
The boundaries of the ego dissolve, the light floods in, and a deep peace sets in. The threshold is always there, just waiting in the background of our minds.
That really brings our deep dive full circle today. We started out looking for hard proof of a DMT flood at the moment of death.
And what we found is that while we don't have definitive proof that human brains release a massive dose of that specific chemical, we uncovered something much more profound.
Right. The brain possesses multiple highly redundant pathways to push consciousness past that physical edge.
Which is precisely why this research should matter to you listening right now. It completely shifts our baseline understanding of what consciousness actually is.
Absolutely.
It is not just a fragile mechanical byproduct of being awake and walking around your neighborhood. It is an intricate, remarkably robust architecture that retains an immense power to generate meaning, even as the biological systems are failing.
That is a beautiful way to put it.
And it is vital to remember that genuine near-death experiences happen completely naturally. No external drug is ever required to touch this state. Your brain is entirely capable of navigating it on its own.
We are fully equipped for the journey. Which leaves me with a thought I really haven't been able to shake since reading through these sources.
What is that?
Well, if the human brain is so hardwired to experience an overwhelming sense of peace, cosmic unity, and luminous presences at the very edge of death, and if accessing the state is so important that biology has provided multiple chemical and electrical pathways to get there, is there a hidden evolutionary advantage to this?
Oh, wow.
Right. Why would biology go out of its way to design such a perfectly peaceful, transcendent dissolving of the self for an organism's final fleeting moments?
That is a big question.
Or is this beautiful doorway just a random cosmic accident of our complex neural wiring? Think about that the next time someone tells you the dying brain simply dumps a single chemical. The reality of what we carry inside our heads is so much bigger.